take this opportunity to thank our sponsors, the law firm once again, as well as the Knish Shop. Also, we have three other sponsors, Yehoshua Barber, Yecheskel Ray, and Shalom Michael. And I want to thank both Ellie Lassen and Nathan Adler for helping out with the coordination of the shiur and arranging the food. This is part two of what will be a two-part series on the obligation and limits of Kiruv. Excuse me. We spent last month, talking about the first half, the nature of the obligation to be involved in Kiruv, to care about our fellow Jews, and rejection, essentially, of the notion that to live and let live is a halachic idea. On the contrary, we do care about other people. We discussed various different possibilities of chiyuvim, what the basis of that care or that need to do something is. Perhaps it was the v'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha, the idea that we're supposed to love Hashem. The love of Hashem, our love of Hashem is not just expressed in how we relate to Him, but a genuine love should be to try to get other people to love Hashem. It's human psychology 101. We mentioned that when you love someone, even a human, a good friend or something, it's human nature to want other people to share that same feeling. So it's a barometer in a certain sense, or a litmus test of our love of Hashem, to the extent that we care and work to see if other people will love Hashem as well. Perhaps v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha is a source or an obligation. After all, if we really believe in the truth and the benefits of Torah lifestyles, of course, by loving and wanting the best for other people, we would want them to love Hashem and have the exposure of the benefits of Torah as well. More to the point, we saw the fact that there are mitzvos, one is called tochech, tochech azam isecha, the idea that, again, in certain contexts, and the purpose of this shiur was not to discuss the how to do this, which is an important part, but all things being equal, there's an obligation if you see someone making a mistake, committing an avera, to rebuke them, to correct them. And we also saw that there's a general notion called arvus, a general obligation known to be an interrelationship and responsibility, kind of as a guarantor of our fellow Jews. So these and other sources point to an obligation, as we mentioned, of caring for and being involved actively in a notion of Kiruv. What I would like to discuss in today's shiur is, in a certain sense, the flip side of that, and that is the limitations when perhaps we would be excused or perhaps even encouraged not to be involved in what is colloquially referred to as Kiruv. Just as last month's shiur, the first half about the obligations, was more of a general overview and certainly not all the details and not all the facts and certainly not all the nuance, so to this half on the limits and the exceptions or exemptions of the obligation to be involved in the Kiruv should also be seen as just that, as something that hopefully will give us an exposure or a sensitivity to issues, but certainly not the last word on any specific issue. I'd like to divide the presentation up this afternoon into four different topics corresponding on your source sheet to the four numbered sections. The first issue that I'd like to discuss is the following question. If you have somebody who would be generally considered a good person, in the sense of a religious person, observant person, but in the moment they happen to be caught up in a particular avera, so they are not in any way what we would categorize as wicked or a rasha as a category, rather are a generally observant good person, but they're in a particular situation of avera, and assuming, and now is not the time to discuss how do you know, but assuming that you are reasonably confident that there is nothing you can do to change this person's opinion or to get them to stop committing that avera, what is your obligation in such a case? Do we say that, listen, since it's going to be a futile attempt anyway, we should leave it alone? Or do we say that, nevertheless, we still do our best and we're still obligated to try to dissuade the person? Now, as I mentioned, how you would have such definitive confidence in knowing that nothing could change the situation, that's hard to know practically. And in fact, many cases would be a question of doubt. If you're looking for source number one, the Hagas Memunios quotes a well-known discussion in Rishonim. There are other sources, primary as well as secondary, that discuss this, but perhaps the most well-known citation of this machlokas is this source, the Hagas Memunios. And he starts off by pointing out that, as I alluded to, the only debate is a case where you know or you think you know, that there's no chance of the kiruv of the tochacha working. Afilu im sipek biyado, safek biyado, if you're not sure, then you still have to do it. That's, if there's any doubt, then you're obligated to try. But what if im vadai lo shlo yikablu? What if you know for sure? So then it seems to be a debate. On the one hand, the Sefer HaYireim, Rabbi Remitz, is quoted as saying that even though perhaps you're not punished for their avera in the sense of being a guarantor, avu ma'isa tochech tochiach lo iftar, you're still obligated. You're never exempt from the obligation of tochech tochiach, even though you know it's not going to work. However, other Rishonim, Rav Moshe Mikutzi, for example, Kosov, he writes that Kamosha Chayev Lomar Dabar Nishma, Kachayev Shalomar Dabar Sheinu Nishma. He cites the well known halacha. Of course, it's a question of when and how to apply it, but here he does that sometimes you could say this is the halachic version of discretion being the better part of valor. Not only not obligated, but he goes further and says perhaps it's better not to say anything, maybe even obligatory, to remain silent. So this is a fascinating debate. Again, the case is you know that it's not going to work. There's nothing practical to be accomplished in that sense. What do you do? The Re'im, the Sefer Yireim says, yes, you're still obligated. Moshe Mikutzi, the Smog, says you are not obligated. What might this machlokas be dependent on, or what larger issues might be at play here? So while we won't get into it now, but just to give you a sense, this may very well relate to the broader discussion of what the role or the purpose of Hochech Tochiach as Amisech is. Until now we've been assuming, and it's certainly a reasonable assumption that we've made, that it is a result-oriented mitzvah, namely that we care about the observance of our fellow Jew, our neighbor, and therefore we are obligated to try to change and affect that. If you take that definition very literally, so in a case where you no longer, or you know you won't have that effect, so it may follow naturally that there's no obligation since the effect can't be accomplished. What would the Yireim think? So it's perhaps possible, this has been suggested, that while he of course does think that it's important to try to help other people with the effect, but he may also believe that there is a separate and additional component to the mitzvah, namely the idea of kind of a macha, namely that it's, it would be problematic if we saw another Jew sinning, violating our beliefs, and we didn't say anything. We were unaffected by that. By saying something, even if we know it won't work, at least we're expressing our dismay. We're at least registering our objection. And as a statement of conscience, in a certain sense, that may be necessary. So it's interesting. That may be the underlying debate here. But either way, on a practical level, this may be our first example of what I would call a limit of Kiruv, namely where you know you are going to be ineffective. However, as I said, the important caveat is how would you really know? And certainly in most cases, it would be hard to say, hard to justify excusing yourself based on that, given the fact that in many, if not most cases, there would at least be some possibility of success, even if not probability. The second issue, and we're progressing, I hope, in what will be a logical order, progression, a second case that I want to discuss now is the question of somebody who's not just happened to sin at the moment, but rather is in the category of a sinner, or more harshly, as a rasha, as a wicked person, someone who has rejected Torah and wholesale and does not observe and does not believe in the mitzvos. The simple understanding is that that's, of course, terrible, but would totally not affect our obligation to reach out to that person. However, there is an opinion of the Shach, and again, given the prominence of the Shach in halachic tradition, it's of consequence that it's his opinion. The Shach suggests Chiddush that perhaps the notion here, he's speaking about the prohibition known as Misayeya. Just to give a moment of background, many of you are familiar with the notion that the prohibition, the Torah prohibition called Lifnei Iver Lo Sitei Neshel, means that we're not allowed to enable someone else to do an Aveira, even though we're not doing anything wrong, you would think, or ostensibly ourselves, but if someone else wants us to help them commit an Aveira, we are not supposed to. The halacha is that that is only a biblical prohibition if the person could not transgress the Aveira without our help. What if the person could do it themselves, but they're lazy? You know, they could just as easily walk into the non-kosher restaurant, but you're going out anyway, so they say, please pick me up a cheeseburger. So in such a situation, there is no Torah violation as neither. However, the Rishonim say that there is a rabbinic prohibition, Nisar Derabanan, known as Misayeya. So in such a situation, the question is, who does Misayeya apply to? In other words, who would be sinning such that even though they could do it on their own, we're prohibited from helping them? And the Shach works under the assumption, it appears, that this idea of Misayeya is itself predicated on an issue we mentioned reviewing last week's shir, and that is of Arvus, a mutual responsibility. The Shach says that even though Lifnei Iver may have very broad application, but because of Misayeya having its real root in the term, the idea of mutual responsibility of Arvus, therefore, he says, there is no prohibition of Misayeya if it's a non-Jew committing the Avera. And that's interesting enough, what's more interesting and maybe more controversial is his continuation, and he says, even a Mumar, again, a Jew who's a wholesale rejecter of tradition and a sinner, even for a Mumar, there is no longer any obligation. In a sense, if he doesn't care about him, if he doesn't care about us, if he's rejected our tradition, why should we care about him? Kind of mentality. It's not just like he wants to do, he's part of us, he's just weak or slipping, but he's rejected us. If he's rejected us, we're not obligated to go out of our way. That seems to be the opinion of the Shach. Now, not everyone agrees, and in fact, some of the Nosei Kelim and Shulchan Aruch, the Dago Mirvava and the Gilyan Marsha, are so astonished by the Shach that they either try to read the simple meaning of the Shach out of the text and come up with different explanations for what he meant, because they simply can't imagine he meant what he seems to say he means. And certainly other poskim who are at least willing to take him at his word, but because they're so scandalized or shocked by this, they reject his approach. That notwithstanding, there are certainly numerous achronim who in various contexts seem to either explicitly or implicitly cite him approvingly, or at least accept the basic premise of this notion. Just to give you two examples from the two most prominent contemporary, more modern, recent Sifrei Halacha, the Aruch HaShulchan and the Bir Halacha, the Mishnah Berurah. So the Aruch HaShulchan, here in the third source on your sheet, describes again the obligation of tochacha, of hocheach, tochiach, asamisecha, of correcting a person or pointing out to them if they are doing something wrong. And he says that's true about people who generally are believers. Aval aparkim b'devei chazal, someone who rejects the oral tradition. So such people ain't shayach tochacha. After all, they're apikarsim, etc. And elit vakech imahem. It wouldn't be productive to try to point anything out to them. You just get into a debate, and we're not obligated to exercise our debating skills. Maybe even we shouldn't, but we certainly are not obligated to. Or another example in the next source, the Bir Halacha, also again in the context of Mecha'a, of Tochacha, refers to Ilu HaPorke Ol Lagamre. For example, a Mechal Shabbos Berhesia, a public desecrator of Shabbos, or someone who is rebellious and that's why he eats non kosher, etc. So somebody is no longer part of our nation in the spiritual sense of commitment to mitzvot. He's no longer an amisecha or reach of a mitzvot, as the term is sometimes referred to, and therefore eino mechuyav lohochicho, says the Bir Halacha. Alluding to this idea, he quotes the Tana de Be'el Yahu, who says, the pasuk says, "Amisecha shehu ahavecha," and namely, "Amisecha in mitzvos." So, if you have somebody who's no longer part of our mitzvah tradition, doesn't care about that, so we may no longer be obligated to them as well. So, if one were to accept this general consensus, this idea of the Shach, so that would be our second limitation, and that would be quite a big limitation in theory, namely the idea that someone who is in the category of Russia, who is not just a happenstance sinner, but a wholesale sinner and violator, we may be obligated and freed from being involved. Now, it doesn't mean we can't, but we may not be obligated to be involved with and care about. Now, I mentioned, and I hedged for a moment, because that's really theoretical for the most part nowadays, because we have to ask ourselves whether we can really say about most of the people that we know, people on our block, people who are our coworkers, even though on the surface they may be completely, unfortunately, distant from Torah tradition, but would they be in this category and receive such a harsh judgment? It's not likely, and this is based on an idea which goes back to the Rambam. The Rambam in Hilchos Mamrim here at the bottom of the page, speaks about the Karaim, the infamous Karaim sect, and they were certainly Rishayim, and there was very harsh halachos that related to them. But the Rambam goes out of his way to say that that's referring to people who knew and rejected. However, their children, who were brought up in the same, in their tradition, who really didn't know any better, Noldu ben Akiraim, Gidlu Osam Aldatam, so they were raised to believe like their parents believe. You know, just like we raise our children based on our beliefs, and while unfortunately sometimes it doesn't work and doesn't take, but as a general rule, we certainly hope, and it's a fact that in most of the cases, we get nachas, our children decide to follow to the best of their ability in our way of life. Karai also wants nachas. Karai also wants to raise his children that way, and presumably will do so, and will more than likely be successful. So someone who was raised that way really didn't know any better. Says the Rambam, in that case, Hari hu ketino shenishba b'neim v'gidluhu. In such a case, we look at it as if they were raised as a halachic category is, as if almost they were kidnapped in a sense. Obviously, in this case, they're not kidnapped. I mean, spiritually, they never had a chance. It's not their fault. They didn't know any better. They were brought up in an environment which taught them, from our perspective, the wrong thing. And therefore, says the Rambam, we don't ignore them. We don't act harshly to them, as might have been implied by the earlier sources, but rather, roi lahachzirin b'tshuva. We davka v'chiyuv called kiruv. We have to bring them close to Hashem and treat them nicely. Ad sheyachzru leit haTorah. We should be nice to them and warm to them and loving to them and try to teach them and bring them back. So this premise that the Rambam lays out for Karaim was not limited to them or their children. Of course, it's a general concept and a category. And in fact, some of the great Gedolim who had to deal with the early generations of reform and the widespread assimilation in Western Europe in particular, they very much accepted this premise and applied it to their own generation. So, for example, on the bottom of the page, you have one of the earliest and most famous of these sources, the Tshuva of the Binyan Sion of Yaakov Ettlinger. If you turn over your source sheet, you have on the top of the page, also from the great German tradition, in the next generation, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, the Malam of Lahoyle, the Binyan Sion, just for biographical information, he lived, was born really at the end of the 18th century and lived towards the end of the 19th century, died in 1871. And the Malam of Lahoyle was born a little bit later, born in towards the middle of the 19th century, and died actually in 1921. So much more recent, but still part of that German tradition, the Shemazah tradition. He also quotes the Binyan Sion, and they both make the point that people who were brought up and don't know any better, even though they're Mechal Shabbos before Hesiod, etc., even if one would want to hold of this Shach and this tradition, like the Rosh Hashulchan or the Bir Halacha, but in fact it doesn't apply to people who really don't know better. Perhaps the most well-known and more recent even source for this notion is the one brought up by the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish actually speaks about this twice in the beginning of his comments in the Cheshkita and Yeredeya, and I have for you here the first one, right, in Siman Aleph, where the Chazon Ish talks about this idea, and how if you have someone who really doesn't know any better, is in essence and tantamount to being brought up in a completely non-Jewish environment, or in this case foreign to tradition, distant from Torah, so such a person is a kosher to be a shochet, assuming they know how. Because we can assume that had they been given a chance, had they been given the right time, attention, and love, and education, they would have lived a different life. And therefore, we can have a different approach to them. So in this third group, we're now speaking about people who, from a observance perspective, may be unfortunately widely non-observant, but given the reality sociologically and their biography indicates that since we can look at them and unfortunately not hold them responsible fully for those actions, so the exemption which we may have had in the previous category from the Shach and others, we may want to hedge against and perhaps say, and this seems to be a very widely accepted approach nowadays, that we would not take that approach to the contemporary generation because of this idea. I just want to point out that from personal experience, it's worth noting that even if we believe this and we accept it, in a certain sense, it sounds more tolerant, but you should just know, imagine putting yourself in the position of someone who was brought up, let's say, reform,
you share this with them, there is a chance that they may appreciate it, but there's also a good chance that they may find it condescending. This again relates to the caveat at the opening of the shiur that we're not getting into how these halachas are applied in the sense of how you talk to a person, how you relate to a person. One has to be certainly be very, very, very careful to constantly do so with derech eretz and with common sense so as not to create a chil Hashem or to be counterproductive. So what can I say? It is a little bit condescending. I think we should be honest, but nevertheless, what can we do? That is how we believe, it seems the consensus, and it should inform what, from our perspective at least, is a more tolerant approach, which, in a certain sense, paradoxically, means that we're still obligated, or more obligated than we might have been otherwise, to be involved. With our remaining minutes of the shiur, I just want to mention one final issue, and that is the idea of cases where maybe we would say not only not obligated, but maybe you shouldn't be involved. And there could be other examples of this. I just want to give you at least an introduction to what your interest and appetite to one concept. There is a text from Tosefta, from Mishnah, which is quoted in Gemara Baba Kama. The case there has to do with someone who has a farmer who is drying out their produce and the hasn't yet taken certain tithes, or there, for whatever reason, it's not yet the fourth year of the produce, which means it's still prohibited, things of that nature, where the farmer, of course, knows it's his produce, he has to do something with it, he has to bring it to Yerushalayim, or who knows what, has to give it to a Kohen, but no one else knows that, he's drying out his crops. So the Gemara quotes an opinion that some held that there's an obligation that one should make markers or signs so that everyone knows that this is food that is not edible, it's prohibited to be eaten. Why? Because after all, as strange as it sounds, what if a robber comes, a thief comes and steals my produce? They're stealing it, thinking it's perfectly kosher and acceptable to eat, but unknowingly they'll be eating food that is prohibited, so therefore we should let them know. That is a shocking, shocking halacha. After all, why should I care about someone who steals from me? But nevertheless, that is an opinion. The Gemara then says, Rabbi Gamliel says no. Imagine we're in Bishvias, in a year like this year in Shemitah, where all of our produce, even if it grows in our field, but isn't essentially a tefker, so it's not stealing, because no one owns it. But Shar Shnei Shavuah, but any other year, if it's not a Shemitah year, we don't care. Ali Teu L'Rosh of Yamus. Let him eat it, let him die. Of course, that's a figure of speech, but it just shows the dismissive and almost disgust that that Rav Shem Gamliel has. It's kind of a property rights, a very intuitive. I think if I asked almost any of you in the room, you would have instinctively had Rabbi Shem Gamliel's approach. Now, my responsibility to be worried about the kashrus of a guy who's stealing from me. However, even though it sounds intuitive on one hand, one of the great, great achronim, the Chavos Yoyer, in his Chuvah Simen Kuf Mem Beis, he says, I don't understand. How could this be? It sounds like it's a general rule of saying, basically, listen, someone who's a thief, we don't have to care about their mitzvah observance. That's not true. Someone who's a thief, maybe that is, to use our terminology, is, quote, not from, but there's an obligation for kiruv. We should care about them. We should care that they keep kashrus. We should try to, of course, convince them not to steal anymore. We do care about them. What do you mean we don't care about them? What about all those good things that we know and love? All of last month's shir of arvus and nocheh tuchiyach and yafruch hachamoch. What do you mean we don't care? In fact, the Chavos Yoyer was so bothered by the Shaila, he leaves it unresolved, and he actually says, "Mi shi'ala arucha l'machalosi b'serof v'yuman yikra." He says, you know, I'm so disturbed that someone could solve this for me, I give them the title of expert doctor. Fascinating. Your mother ever hoped you were a doctor, this may be a way. So while we're not going to have time to get into all of the issues of this topic, because there are other answers to the question, I just want to conclude by mentioning that there is at least one approach to this category called Hanatei Lashon V'Yamus, which relates to our topic of the shir. Namely, based on a comment of the Akedas Yitzchak, who dealt with an astonishing, salacious case of a community which the young men were being involved, unfortunately, in the prohibition of adultery. They were acting inappropriately with married women. So the suggestion was, why don't we get the Beis Yaakov girls? We should get single girls to be with them, and even though that's not a good thing, but it's certainly a less serious avera than adultery, than inappropriate behavior with a married woman. Astonishing as that is, there was such a suggestion. And the Akedas Yitzchak says, and this is quoted here, for example, by the Maharsham, the Chalila of a Chalila, of course we shouldn't do that. Yes, it's true, you could argue we're lessening their averas, isn't that Kiruv? We're lessening their averas. But he points out, to paraphrase the Maharsham, you still can't do that. Because Oven Katan Bereshus Bezdin, Harbe Yoser Chomer, may Avon Godol Shalom Rishus Bezdin. In other words, we can't give our stamp or seal of approval to something, even if it's a lesser Avera, because that compromises the halachic integrity, that compromises our integrity. As much as we love Kiruv, as much as we love other Jews, we would like to lessen their Averos, if by doing so we would be tacitly approving of the lesser Avera, that is a compromise of our integrity, which we can no longer do. Marsham does not explicitly quote this regarding Ha'itel Rosh of Yamos, but in a similar tshuva that Tzitz Eliezer more recently does apply this same idea explicitly, and he suggests that's the explanation of Ha'itel Rosh of Yamos. We can't put our gushpanka, as he calls it, we can't put our stamp of approval on someone's inappropriate behavior or prohibited behavior, even if it's a lesser Avera, we've in that sense saved them, we've done Kiruv, but if it would require us to compromise our integrity, compromise our halachic principles, then we can't do it, even though on some level we might be sincerely motivated to help that person. So this would be another example, again, the details of how to apply this are very tricky and we're not getting into, but another category, a very fascinating category to consider is sometimes there might not be, not only might there not be an obligation, but there may even be a prohibition or an inappropriateness to be involved in Kiruv if so doing compromised our integrity or gave an impression that we were tacitly approving inappropriate or prohibited behavior. So these are just some of the issues, again, just a rough, quick overview of topics, both as we did last time, the obligations of Kiruv, and here are some possible categories of exemptions and perhaps even discouragements from being involved in those details. Of course, I think, as I mentioned last time, it's not a coincidence that we gave the shear of obligations first, because our instinct, our first response should be certainly a sense of Avas Yisrael, and not only Ava, but responsibility, Achrayas, and our impulse certainly should be towards Kiruv. We should be aware not only of those obligations, but where there may be limitations as well. Everyone should be well, and have a wonderful, wonderful Hanukkah. Take care. Thank you.